So our series is Paul's Odyssey. We're looking at the three missionary trips of the Apostle Paul over a three-year period, spending 3 months on each missionary trip. We're in our third trip now, and we're looking at Paul's third missionary trip, if you will. We left the Apostle Paul last week in the great city, a mega city of our map. Ephesus, do we have a map up there? Lisa, there you go. Thank you. Ephesus is here. The Apostle Paul started on this end of Turkey, down through here, down to a city called Antioch, his home church. 800-mile journey walking. He comes over to Ephesus. He spends 3 years in the city of Ephesus there. And the Bible is... Dr. Luke doesn't go into a lot of detail, sort of sums it up. Once he left his three-year journey here in Ephesus, he headed north by northwest, and he began to revisit all the churches that he had started in his other trips up here in Macedonia. We know Macedonia from one particular person, a very famous person. Alexander the Great, okay, came out of Macedonia here, northern Greece. He went to Achaia. But what we see here, if you just follow what the book of Acts says, you begin to think, okay, he looped down here, visited all of these churches, and he came back, went over here, somewhere over there to Jerusalem, way over there, a long way. But what we miss are the other passages in the Bible from the book of 1 Corinthians, book of 2 Corinthians, and also the book of Romans that give detail to some of what is missing in the book of Acts. Because here in Ephesus, Paul writes the book of 1 Corinthians. That's the fourth book that he writes. Previously, he wrote Galatians, 1 and 2 Thessalonians. He writes 1 Corinthians here. He goes north up here to Philippi. He writes a book of 2, what do you think? Corinthians. Then when he comes down here to Corinth, a city where he's been at before and spent 18 months there, he writes a book of, anyone know? Book of Romans, one of the key doctrinal books in the Bible. So this is, he writes those three on this third journey. He's been winning people to Christ. He's been planting churches. He's encouraging Christians who have been, that he's led to the Lord and are now in these fledgling little churches. He's seeing God do some miraculous things. While he's in Ephesus, we read of some miracles and more miracles as he's going through this area. God's really doing something here, if you will, to stir things up, to because they've never heard of Jesus before. Paul's bringing the gospel to them. So we begin to see his miracles as God works in and through them. And the one key thing that is almost missed as you read through this third missionary trip is how he begins to bring men and women alongside of him, begins to train them not only to lead these churches, but ultimately to go out from there around the Roman world, which is quite big at that point, to take the gospel to them. Six books of the Bible are written at this point. It's easy to read through the book of Acts and just think that Paul is wandering. Guess by golly, where do I go today? Which way is the wind blowing? Or that we use the phrase in America, a wandering Jew, as we think of the lost 10 tribes of Israel. He's not just wandering. He's being driven by God. He's listening to God. Where does God want him? God shuts the doors someplace, opens doors in other places. So he goes through Macedonia, and as he goes to Macedonia, one key thing that Romans tells us here, Romans chapter 15 and verse 19, we learn this, that while Paul is coming down this way, the average chart that you're going to see of Paul's third journey, it looks like he went through Macedonia, Greece, or Achaia 3 months here, and then he came back. That's not true. That's why you have to read all of the Bible to understand any bit of the Bible. So you with me on that? You can't just take part of the story. While Paul is here, he heads across. There's a major highway. Think of I-96 connecting the west side, east side of the state. He takes his highway all the way here, and he goes up, and if there were a map, he goes way up there into a province where if you're on the shoreline, you're seeing Italy. He's still in what we would call today the old Yugoslavia, or if you've ever heard of the country of Albania, that's where he is. And he goes up there for a period of time. We don't know exactly how long he was there or what he did, but then he came back down the coast, maybe back here to this city here, Berea, Thessalonica, and then came down to Achaia. We do know this. He spent 3 months there. There's a lot in his journeys that we don't what? No, just like if you told me you went on vacation and you summarized the vacation, would I know everything that you did? No, we don't. But by reading all the books of the Bible, we get a better picture. By the time Paul works his way back up here, he spent 4.5 years away from his home church. Walking, sailing, being beaten up, thrown in jail, seeing God do tremendous miracles, and etc. So he goes back through this region, and now he's saying in the scripture that he wants to go to Jerusalem. This is the end game. He's on this trip, but he knows he has to get back to Jerusalem, and he's in a hurry. Scripture several times alludes to the fact that he's in a hurry. Why? Because in Jerusalem, there's going to be a major religious festival called the Feast of Pentecost. You ever hear of that? Pentecost. It's a big deal for a Jewish person. They have a number of religious feasts. Three of them are required, the males are required to go to Jerusalem, if at all possible, to go to Jerusalem. Feast of Pentecost is one of them. So it's like he's got his little watch out or his day timer, whatever he's got. He's checking off the days. He's trying to figure out, I've got to be here to catch a boat to go there. So he's hurrying through this area. But in addition, the day of Pentecost has another meaning, not just to a Jew. See, he's got Jewish friends, a Jewish family. He wants to get back and celebrate the Jewish festival, but he's a Christian. Do you know what he also wants to celebrate on the Feast of Pentecost? Okay, the Holy Spirit came on the day of Pentecost. True. It's the birth of the church. Happened on the day of Pentecost. It's kind of like he's going to a birthday what? Birthday party. So as a Jew, as a Christian, he wants to get back for this. And I thought to myself, if I could go and revisit places that where I've gone and had a spiritual influence. Remember, Paul's visited all of this area before on a second journey. He's going to revisit it because in his mind, he really has a sense from the Lord, I'm not coming back this way again. Now think, I'm sitting at my desk and I'm thinking, if I had to go back to certain places, visit with certain people where I've previously made a spiritual difference in my life, and I knew this was going to be my last giddy up, all right, and I'm not coming, where would I go? Where would you go? If you could go back anywhere, remember, add the spiritual dimension, to somebody that influenced you or you influenced them, back to a place where God, you met God, where God did something significant. He saved you from near death. Where would you go? And I thought about that this week. Where would you go? Who would you want to talk to? And what would you say to them? That's a great question. A person sent me a little thing on Facebook today. It was a real estate listing. And it just brought back a flood of memories. The house that I grew up with from age 5 to age 20. When I graduated from high school, my mom sold the house. It was moved to another location. I've only visited that house one other time from the age 20. Till now, and it came up and it said it's for sale, and it actually had pictures of the house. I had to see the picture. I'm going through there looking at the house going, oh, instantly memories came back. When where's Ev at? There's my wife. She's normally sitting there. I took Evie there one other time, the one time I've ever visited a house in the past 50 years. Remember, we went, And I had to go to the garage, same garage, because I wrote my initials with a girl's initials up in the attic. I had to go see if they were there. That was very meaningful to my wife. Yeah, right. Where would you go? Who would you talk to? I want you to think about that this week, because none of us are getting any younger. And there's going to come a time when the people who were important to you coming to faith, they're not going to be there anymore. Places where you were when God did something significant in your life, they may tear down, they may move. Where would you go? Who would you see? And what would you say to them? I've got in my mind three or four people, two or three places that I'm going to go in the next month when I can squeeze this into my travel schedule in August. People I want to say thank you to. Places where I want to go and just maybe place my hand on a wall. If anybody here knows where Becky's Rental is in Battle Creek, that was one of the key places in my life that helped change my life around. And I'm going to just drive by and stop there and just reminisce about what God did in my life. Who would you talk to? What would you say? And where would you go? Think about that this week, because this is what Paul's doing. Acts 20, verse 1 through 16. You'll need to be in Acts 20. Last week we looked at verse 1 through 16. Paul begins his trip in Jerusalem. He's made progress, as we see on our map, to Macedonia, Greece, the city of Philippi, Troas, and now he's going off to a city of Assos. That's where we left him last week. On the return trip, Paul has come down. He spends 3 months here in this church that he planted that has a lot of problems. When you read 1st, 2nd Corinthians, they are the most immature group of people that Paul ever deals with. Okay? Always keep that in mind when you read anything. It's real tough to build doctrine out of 1st Corinthians or 2nd Corinthians because they're so messed up. Paul has to constantly deal with them. Paul spends 3 months here. He begins his journey up here. Some of his followers take a boat. They go over here to Troas because that's the way to get back into Turkey. Paul is up here. He knows there's a plot to kill him again. It's kind of like, leave the man alone. He's just trying to serve God. People are after him all the time. Paul is up here in Philippi. Most of his tag-alongs have moved on across. Paul is now going to join them. And it's kind of like he throws a curveball to the people trying to kill him. He sends his bodyguards ahead, and he stays back a little bit, and then he comes. Now we're in Acts 20, look at verse 13. We went on ahead to the ship and sailed for Assos. It's one of these little city on the coast of Turkey. Luke is writing this, where we were going to take Paul aboard. Paul is now waiting for them. He had made this arrangement because he was going there on foot. So this is the normal type of ship that they would have traveled on here. It's not a very big ship, and if there's a big wave, you say what? Goodbye. Okay? The Mediterranean can be an unforgiving piece of water, GNC also. So they had to only sail during certain months of the year you'd risk your life going any other time. So he goes to Assos, where he's going to take Paul aboard. We had made this arrangement because he was going there on foot. He's walking there. We dealt with that last week. Verse 14. When he met us at Assos, we took him aboard, and we went on to this next city, Mytilene. It sounds Italian, but that's how it's pronounced. The next day, we set sail from there and off to Chios. The day after, we crossed over to Samos, and on the following day, we arrived at Miletus. A lot of names there, and as we were looking at the map, we would understand where all these little islands, where all these little ports were. You just didn't jump on an ocean liner and set sail. You could only go as far as the weather was good, and we don't know how long he stayed in any one of these places, how many hours. Now look at verse 16. They're just north of Ephesians, of the city of Ephesus, where he had previously spent 3 years. Paul had decided to sail what? Past Ephesus. He'd been there 3 years. Why wouldn't he go back? You ever been someplace that, don't need to see it again? Yeah, that's one of the reasons. He spent 3 years of his life there. But also when Paul left, there was this huge riot and they were trying to kill him and all the other Christians. Probably God saying, let's not go back there. Okay, there's bigger and better things for you. Paul had decided to sail past Ephesus to avoid spending time in the province of Asia. It's not that he didn't like it. He had been there multiple times. He's in a hurry, for he was in a hurry to reach what? Jerusalem, if possible, by the day of Pentecost. Again, one of the big Jewish feasts. Secondly, it's the birthday of the church. So, did you catch this? He sailed past Ephesus, spent 3 years there. He had built the church. It's one of the healthiest churches in the New Testament. But remember, they had revolted against Paul and his work. A bunch of pagans got together because they were losing income because so many people were coming to faith. They were not able to sell their little idols anymore. It's just best not to go. In addition, Paul's got a church there. Think about this. He spent 3 years. 3 years there. If he came back, it'd be like many people in America. When you leave a home church and you go south and you come back in the springtime, you're going to be potlucked to death with all of your friends. Okay? So he knows, if I go here, I can't hurry. I'm going to be going to Aunt Betty's house and Tommy's house and this person. No, it's just best not to go. So he goes to the city of Miletus. It's about 30 miles south on the coast. I've been to both Ephesus and to Miletus. There's only one place in Miletus where Paul would have gathered with these people. I had the privilege to go and stand in this spot. It's kind of like you hear about some of our great battlefields, and you go there, and you try to envision it all, or you go to a place where some great event happened. Same thing. I'm standing in Miletus trying to picture this, and in Acts 20, verse 17, you there? From Miletus, Paul sent to Ephesus for the elders of the church. Why didn't he go there? Multiple reasons. He goes to the next port south. He says, now send word back up 30 miles. That is a day and a half to 2 day journey. Send word up there. Get the Ephesian elders, in other words, the pastors and leaders of that church and those churches that have spawned off from that up there. Paul's waiting there in Miletus, 30 miles south. We're going to assume 2 days up there. 2 days what? Back. We don't know how long it took to get them. Okay, if I said to the elders, pack your bags, we're going down to Athens, Michigan. We're going to spend some time there. You don't just jump in on your pony and off you go. You got to take care of some details. So we're going to assume minimum there's a week worth of time that goes by. Ephesus was the major city. Miletus was the previous great city. It's a city that had four harbors. You go there today and you're going, where's the water? Where's the water? Any great river, think of the Mississippi, the Delta. The Delta is formed by what? It's where the rivers come together, but also all of the minerals, all of the dirt, all of the stuff upriver that comes down and settles. That's what happened to both in this city and also up in Ephesus. The rivers took over everything, dumped everything. If you're standing where I'm standing and I'm trying to picture how did Paul land here, and we're talking 6 miles of silt in front of him. This is all filled in now. But back then, you could picture it. Paul is there. He's waiting for the leaders of the church to come. In Acts 20, 17 through 18, this is the most emotional and the most personal piece of scripture the Apostle Paul ever wrote, or is written about him, put it that way. Acts 20, 17 through 38. As Luke records it, we really get a glimpse into Paul's heart, into his mind. We see the tension, we see his passion, we see his concern. Many of us have letters that we've cherished from people over the years. Remember that first love note that you've probably got stuffed away? Roses are red, violets are blue. It was written in kindergarten handwriting, and you just cherish that to this moment. This was Paul's heartbeat to this church, and he's talking to their leaders. It's many people have called this Paul's locker room talk. Others have called it the grand goodbye. One author said it's the fine farewell or farewell. You and I know we use words or heard words in our culture just simply to say goodbye. There's other words. Give me one. So long, what else? Adios, sorry, what else? Farewell, cheerio. You ever hear that in a movie? Bon voyage. What do the Italians say? Ciao. It's not spelled C-H-O-W, okay, but that's how Americans would spell. Adieu. You ever hear that? French. The word adieu, I can't say it like a French person because your lips got to go together here. But adieu, here's the meaning of it. When a French person uses that as a way of saying goodbye to somebody, it literally means, I commit you to God. It means this, that when we die, we'll meet each other in front of God. So when you say, I do, that really has some meaning to it. That's what this whole passage is. Paul is saying, I may never pass this way, what? Again. So I've broken this text from verse 17 through 38 into three, if you will, manageable pieces. It captures the joy of his heart, but also the sorrow of his heart. He will probably never see them again. We don't know for sure. We don't know everything that happened in the Bible, but Paul's basically saying goodbye. As you read these passages, think of how Paul sacrificed for 3 years with these people, how he served them, how he suffered, but also how he shared his life with them. This is an emotional piece. If you will stop and think of saying goodbye to people that you've poured your guts into. I coached football for a lot of years. One of the hardest moments in the football season was never a particular game. It's that last game when the last play happens. You gather your team out in maybe on the 50-yard line, and particularly your seniors who've busted themselves for 6 to 7 years, lifting weights, running, sweating, and winning and losing, and you have to say what? Goodbye. They'll never play football, organized football, the vast majority of them, ever again in their life. You'll never get to coach these kids again. It's an emotional time. All of us have had those, haven't we? With somebody. Olivia Newton-John sang a song that says, it's so hard to say goodbye. So here's the three pieces we break it into. Verse 17 through 27 is the commitment that Paul exhibited. The commitment that Paul exhibited. We see his commitment to Christ. We see his commitment, particularly here to the Ephesian church, but we also see his commitment to the commission of making disciples. Paul was not somebody that, well, if the sun's out, I'm going to the beach today and I'm not going to hang out with Christians. He understood that God's spiritual family is important, that Jesus gave his life, not just to set individuals free. Jesus gave his life to form a spiritual family called the church, and he was very, very committed to this. We see his commitment. In America, in our English language, we would say, actions what? Speak louder than words. As Christians, churchgoers, we often give we use the right words, but our actions tell something totally different in terms of our commitment to the Lord, commitment to our families, commitment to work, but also committed to God's church. Actions speak, say it, louder than what? Than words. See, church, you either view church as an organization or you view it as a living organism. This is Jesus incarnate because he indwells every true believer here. You're on one side or the other. You're not in the middle. And because we live in a secular society where we are used to bouncing from school to school, job to job, location to location, we just begin to think that's okay to do with church. There's no commitment in our lives to people because we view people only as objects, not people indwelt by Jesus. And that the church is his family, not the building, the family. And people just walk away. They walk from one church to another. They never talk about any issues that they may have. They just drift. That is not biblical. That is not a biblical way of handling the family of God. So we see Paul's commitment. He comes together with these believers. Now, Paul is pointing out something here that Jesus taught, and that we see throughout Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. In Mark 2, there was a time when Jesus is teaching a group like this, and all of a sudden, stuff starts falling from the ceiling. He's teaching away, and all of a sudden, bigger chunks are falling from the ceiling. It's found in Mark chapter 2. And it says there's the group of people, they've got a friend of theirs who's paralyzed, so they bring him on a stretcher to Jesus. They show up at the door, there's so many people inside, they can't get in, they can't get to the windows because there's a lot of big people standing in front of the windows there to catch a breeze. They can't get their friend to Jesus, so they climb up on top of the roof and start digging a hole in it. Have you ever been that desperate to get somebody to Jesus? So Jesus is teaching away, stuff's falling here, and all of a sudden it says they lower him down, which tells me there had to have been a woman or two in that group. Because if there's a bunch of buddies up there with the friend, they would say something like, well, let's just drop him. He's paralyzed. He's not going to feel it anyway, right? See the difference between the way women and men think? So they lower him down, and then it says this in Mark 2, verse 5, when Jesus saw their faith. Do you realize people can see your faith? Actions what? Speak louder than words. Here in this passage in verse 17, if you're looking at the passage, you're looking at the Bible there, verse 17, it says, Paul sent. Verse 18, Paul said to them, you know how I lived the whole time. Verse 19, I serve the Lord. Verse 20, you know that I have not hesitated to preach. Verse 21, I have declared. I throughout that text. But Paul is saying this, do you see my faith? You can see my faith, can't you? Good question to ask yourself as you leave today. When God looks at you, what does he see? Does he see hypocrisy? Where you say one thing but live what? Another way? Do your fellow Christians see your commitment to them by your attendance, by your service in ministry, etc.? Faith can be what? Seen. Anybody can use words and say, I'm a Christian, I'm committed, I'm. It's seen along with the words. It's not one and it's not the other. Paul simply says, I've tried to be a good what? Example to you. And he's saying, you guys should do what I do. Your commitment is seen. He lived his life as a model, as did Jesus. And why? Because Paul knew that his salvation was not earned. He knew that his salvation was a gift from who? From God. He knows that Jesus died to give him new life. And he lives his life, why? Out of gratitude to Jesus, but also because if Jesus loved me enough to save me, and he loves you enough to save you, then we ought to play nice together. And we should serve one another. And quit being selfish. And quit demanding our own way. Faith is seen in our actions, not just in our words. So look at verse 26, 27. Because we're talking about the fact that his commitment is exhibited. You can see his commitment, and God would look at you today, and he sees something in terms of your actions. Look at verse 26, 27. Therefore, Paul wraps this little section up. He's reminding them, I'm not going to be here anymore to live as an example. y'all got to carry your own load. If there's going to be a church tomorrow, they've got to see it in you today. Does that make sense? So look at verse 26 and then verse 27. Therefore is one of those big words in the Bible. When you read it, therefore always means this. Because of everything I just said, therefore you're to do this, you're to think this, you're to be this. Therefore is a transition. It's one of those words you should go, what's the big point here, Paul? Therefore, I declare to you today that I am innocent of the blood of any of you. What? What he's basically saying is this. I'm leaving. If you make it, it's going to be on you. I'm innocent. I've done the best that I know how. What kind of pastor would say that? A pastor who really cares about people. It's time to grow up. It's time to embrace your own faith. It's time to be the next generation of leaders in Ephesus, in the province of Asia. I'm innocent. I've done the best I know how. For I have not hesitated to proclaim to you the whole will of God. I've done the best I know how. Now it's on. Every pastor that dies in the pulpit, every pastor that retires is thinking these same things. I've poured my guts into you. It's now up to you. Parents, isn't that what you think about your own kids? Anybody here perfect? No perfect parents. No perfect employer. No perfect pastors. All we can do is do the best we know how. And if it catches, it catches. That was the commitment that he tried to live out in front of them. The church where he had been the absolutely the longest tenure. He says, that's it. I'm leaving. The church is going to make it. It's going to be up to you. Look at verse 28 through 35. This is the counsel that Paul expressed. He communicated passionately and truthfully for 3 years. It doesn't seem like a long time, but 3 years was long back in those days. Because Paul isn't just showing up on Sundays. Paul is with these people every day of the week. Different groups, different homes, different meetings. For 3 years, he's put himself into these people's lives. And as he teaches through this here, he makes 3 points. In verse 28, if you're looking at verse 28, he talks about the gravity, if you will, or the importance of caring and shepherding. He's telling the elders, it is very important. I cannot understate this, he says. We would use the term, the gravity of the situation. He says, you have to be good examples, shepherds, elders. Why? Because you're the leaders of the flock now. Parents, you have to be good examples of a believer. Why? Because you got little eyes that are what? Watching you, little ears that are listening to you, and little feet that are trying to fill your steps. We all lead somebody. And he's stressing to the elders here, it's critical that you live your lives well. You're not better than, you're just the most obvious example of. Verse 29 through 31 is the necessity of guarding people from the dangerous influences of the enemy. The necessity of guarding those people. One is you better grow up, watch your own life. The second thing is the necessity of guarding others. Why? Because there's evil forces that are trying to destroy every church in America. And he points out 2 things. The first is a group of people who will bring, if you will, false teaching into a church. Just because we're a church doesn't mean we're open to every crazy idea that everybody in America has. If it's not biblical, we don't follow it. It's that simple. But he says, look at verse 30, and he calls these people savage wolves. What does the Bible refer to Christians as? What animal? Sheep. He says there are savage, what? Are they nice wolves? What's the word? We better understand this as a church. People who would bring false teaching into a church are savage wolves. But then in verse 30, he says, even from your own number, men will show up. From your own number, there will be people who try to take away groups of people from within your own congregation to follow their ideas, their beliefs, their concept of what church is. And he calls them not a nice term. It's called savage wolves. What? Savage wolves. It's the elder's responsibility in a church to safeguard the flock from false teaching, but also from people who would attempt to bring what the Bible calls sowing discord and dissension. Verse 32 through 35 is the intentionality of building others up. The intentionality of building others up. He says to these elders, the leaders of the church that he's left, that you have to pour into people. There's times when it's not convenient. There's times when you're tired of people. There's times when you're just flat tired, you're sick, whatever. He says we have to help people grow up and present them to Christ. When we dare, as moms and dads, children's workers, teen workers, elders, deacons, when we dare to show up, to stand up and speak up for God, you put a big target on your back. Satan comes looking for you. It's a strategy from Old Testament to New Testament. Find out who's a leader and target them, to destroy their family. If you're going to stand up for God, you put yourself at risk. Now, while you're at risk, remember, if you're walking with the Lord, God's got you. Does that make sense? But we have to understand that. There's a tremendous burden in being a leader of a church. You're not always everybody's nice guy. There's always somebody that's got their feathers what? Ruffled. And whatever it is that's tied in a knot. I forget how that goes. There's always somebody that doesn't like you. Well, hey, look in the mirror. Your own spouse and your own children don't always love you. So if you don't like the leadership of a church, just remember, there's somebody out there who has the same feelings towards you. It's how you deal with those feelings and that attitude that really matter. So if you're going to be a leader of a home group, you're going to be a leader in a ministry, a leader in a church, you better, we would say, have thick what? Now, it's not really like tink, I don't care about you, it bounces off of me. It's just that a thick skin also implies this, you can absorb a lot more. And if you're going to, you know, be a little person, oh, everybody's upset with me, you need to find something else to do besides be involved in church ministry. Because in church ministry, it's messy. Say the word messy. Okay, a lot of images went through your mind. Welcome to the world of the church. A person who loves God, truly loves people, has thick skin. It doesn't bounce off from them. Everybody's got a heart, right? It means this, that I'm willing to absorb more of your criticism, more of your lousy attitude, more of your inconsistent behavior. Why? Because I love Jesus and love you. That's what it means to serve in a local church. Ultimately, as a church leader, and ultimately as a parent, this is hard. But ultimately, you're going to realize this. Thinking of your kids, thinking of those that you lead in a business, think of those you lead in a church. We in America, we have a saying. It says, you can lead a horse what? But you can only do what you can do. And if they want to be immature, they want to have a bad attitude, they want to walk away and shirk their responsibilities, that's on them. That is not a reflection of you as a parent, as an employer, or as a leader in church. People make their own what? Their own choices. Lastly, verse 36 through 38. Paul, at this point, he's weeping because it's coming to an end. Verse 36. When Paul had finished speaking, he knelt down with all of them and prayed. They all what? Well, what's he doing? That's not what a man does. They all wept and embraced him and kissed him. Now, it's not mouth to mouth. Think of the culture. Okay? And they probably are all wearing masks because they've read the mandates. Verse 38, what grieved them most was his statement that they would never see his face again. Then they accompanied him to the ship. And I can see them all on the shore going. And Paul's doing the same. The camaraderie that Paul experienced. Camaraderie is a feeling of friendliness, goodwill, trust, and being familiar, the emotions that come from being familiar with a group of friends. It comes from spending time with people. You can't have a sense of camaraderie. People say, well, I just don't feel connected to that church. How much effort are you putting, how much time are you putting into getting to know people within that church? Having spent time together, sharing the same values, enjoying or surviving common experiences, and working together always with something bigger than your own little life. That's how you build camaraderie in a church. That's how you build it in a family. That's how you build it in a business. Agreed? Paul experienced camaraderie from these people. It wasn't just because he spent 3 years. That's a lot of time. But it's also all the things that they went through. Camaraderie, one author said, it's what you think, it's what you feel when somebody says, if you had something important to do, who would you want with you? Don't you get names, faces that pop into mind? They're people that you're familiar with, people that you care about, people that you know care about you, people that you can trust, people that you can rely on, people who will do what they've said they will do and will be committed through hell and high what? High water. That's camaraderie. You see, in Paul's culture here, church was not something you attend once a week. Church is who we are. Do you see the difference? A lot of people in America do not. Church is like going to Walmart, going to Meijer, going to Costco. Whatever itch I have, I meet it here. There's a lot of people who do church that way. Because they don't understand the sense of biblical fellowship or camaraderie. When we look at this passage, there's a number of powerful truths. But here's one. In order to have great relationships in any group, including your own family, you must be open and holy, W-H-O-L-L-Y, holy, not like whole, but wholly committed to the group or to the person. Yeah, but what if they're not? Has nothing to do with them. Has everything to do with your attitude and your action, your behavior, your mouth. You have to be the committed one. It's a wonderful truth. If we're going to have camaraderie in this church moving forward, you have to just decide, are you committed to Christ? Are you committed to this group? It's either yay or nay, because in biblical terminology, there's no middle ground. You either are or you aren't. What we have to do is be biblical in how we handle things. Not emotional, but biblical. As we wrap up this third missionary journey, he's just now getting ready to go back to Jerusalem. Next few weeks, we'll look at what happens there. Because Paul jumps out of the frying pan, where? Into the fire. That's coming up in the next few weeks. As we look at this journey, you should almost find a mirror at home and look at yourself in the mirror. Our faith can be seen, not here. It's with everything that you do. Your faith to God, your faith to others in your church, your faith at work, your faith in this country. It's seen by your actions, not just your words. In America, we have another saying that says this, talk is really cheap. Talk is cheap. Why does America have all these goofy sayings? Put your money where your mouth is. If this is your church, then be committed to the church. If it's not, quit playing the game. If God is your Savior, then live like He's your Savior and live differently. We need to think about our commitment to Christ. Look in the mirror and ask yourself, am I really Because you can't just say yes because you said a prayer. It's yes, I'm committed to Christ because I've rearranged my priorities around His. Talk is cheap. Are we really committed to His church? I've said this for years here. Are you serving anywhere in a church ministry? Are you taking advantage of some of our growth opportunities, whether it's mentoring, whether it's our classes, or our home groups? Talk is what? Cheap. Don't tell me what a good Christian you are if you're not serving and if you're not growing. And talk is cheap when we say, yeah, people are going to hell, but I'm not doing a thing about it. We've all got friends and family that need Jesus. Is that agreed? Then all we ask you to do is between now, which is August, September, October, November, December, you have 5 months to pray for people, be kind to people, invite people if you get a chance, introduce them to other Christian, valid, authentic Christian people, and then when you can get them into a church situation, do so, but otherwise, just start telling them the story. God's story of Jesus, say that, God's story of Jesus, and my story with Jesus. Say it. That's all you can do. The rest is on them. But it would be a shame in the next 5 months to have one of your family, one of your friends, one of your co-workers, one of your students, one of your teachers die having never heard about Jesus. You're not responsible for whether they accept Him or not. You're responsible to what? To tell them. The choice is ours. We have to determine, are we authentic Christians or are we simply churchgoers who are religious? Is that, don't you love coming to church and feeling like somebody just slapped you? Folks, you're lucky Paul's not here. He could get off on people. I pray that God would use you in the coming week to show your commitment to other believers by encouraging them, by praying for them, by loving on them, showing your commitment to the lost by doing the exact same thing. And at the end of the week, let's just let God produce the fruit. Let's just be faithful. Can we do that? What do you think? Ed, you going to do that this week? Thank you.